The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Barbara F. Walter. Political scientist Barbara F. Walter is the author of Reputation and Civil War, Why Separatist Conflicts Are So Violent, Globalization, Territoriality and Conflict, and Civil Wars, Insecurity and Intervention. The Rohr Chair in Pacific International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is on the editorial boards of the American Political Science Review, the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and International Studies Quarterly, among other academic journals. Dr. Walter has received grants and fellowships from the National Science Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, and the United States Institute of Peace. She joins us tonight with How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them, a very important part of this topic. In it, she examines the substantial increase in violent extremism around the globe in order to explore the rising possibility of a second U.S. civil war. A reviewer in the Washington Post writes that this book is a much-needed warning that uses cross-national research to examine the United States, and that it is a warning to heed. I've been skeptical of the notion that the United States is on the verge of another civil war. Walter has made me reconsider. This is a book that everyone in power should read immediately. Not so coincidentally, that review was written by tonight's interlocutor, Jacob S. Hacker, the Stanley B. Resser Professor of Political Science and the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University. He is the author of The Great Risk Shift and The Divided Welfare State, and the co-author of Let Them Eat Tweets and American Amnesia, among several other books. Dr. Hacker is a board member of the American Prospect, the Economic Policy Institute, and the Century Foundation. Thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you mentioned that I was the author of that review, because I was afraid that I would have to break it to you, Jason. Guess what? So anyway, I'm so pleased to be here. I'm pleased to be here for one thing, because I love all of the words that are on the screen here. Free Library of Philadelphia. Those are all good words, especially public library, which are an important institution in our society. And I'm so glad that they're hosting us here today. So I got asked to do this a few days ago, and I jumped at the chance because, first, I think this is a great book. And I hope that you guys we'll all be getting it and reading it, and at least by the time we're done talking, you'll definitely want to get it if you haven't. And second of all, it intersects with a lot of the thinking I've been doing, but from a totally different perspective. So I'm a scholar of American politics. I've been really interested in the transformation of our politics over the last generation, particularly the growing polarization between the parties. And as I said in that review, I've been pretty skeptical that the end point of this growing polarization is going to be violent conflict. And my skepticism is in part a reflection, I think, of some misperceptions about the nature of civil conflicts in the modern world. And so this was one of these chances for me to be exposed to another part of my own discipline. So, and in the process, to learn a lot about aspects of American politics that, for all the work I've done on it, I hadn't really considered in this light. So that's just to say that I'm really glad to be able to be here and talking with you today, Barbara.
Yeah, it's a thrill to be here talking to you. So thank you.
So I guess I'll start with a kind of I don't know if to say it's a parochial question, but it's a question about political science. So we are a discipline that, unlike I'd say economics and maybe sociology to some degree, is not sort of as public facing, right? I mean, you can all think of a few prominent economists. You might know us, but probably you can't think of a ton of prominent political scientists. And it's because I think the discipline has not put as much value on this kind of public facing work. And I'm reminded that at one point I was sort of in correspondence with the great economist Ed Lindblom, who passed away a few years ago. And the question was asked of him by someone in this conversation, did he have any regrets about you know, his career? And he said, well, he said, first, you know, if I was doing it again, I'd learn to dance better. And then he said, second, which is a good answer, I have to say.
Now I want to know him.
Yeah. And the second thing he said is, I would read less political science, which was a real like dagger to the heart. So this is a really readable book, unlike some of the work in our discipline. But tell us a little bit about why you wanted to write a book for a broader audience about work that, you know, scholarly work that you've been doing for a long time.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a kid of immigrants. My mom didn't go to college. My parents started a tiny company in Yonkers, New York. They were scrappy. They didn't have a lot of money. They really struggled to pull the money together to send. There were three of us, my siblings and I, to college. And they certainly were not supportive of me going and getting a PhD in political science because they needed money and they worried that I would never be able to support myself. But what really drove me from the beginning was problems. You know, we talked a lot about world affairs every dinner growing up. And we, you know, both of my parents lived through World War II. And it was just front and center in our focus. And I just wanted to figure out solutions to those problems. And so I went to grad school and I did my dissertation, and then my first book was called Committing to Peace. And it started with this puzzle, which was, geez, you know, civil wars, unlike wars between countries, don't end in negotiated settlements. At the time, 80% of them were fought to the death. And I just found this astounding and disturbing. You know, civil wars are usually enormously costly. Like, why would people fight to the death sometimes for decades? And so I wrote this book that really figured out what the strategic problem was. And really it came down to, in civil wars, one side has to disarm and demobilize. And they don't like to do that because it makes them sitting ducks for a surprise attack. And early on in my career, I started to be asked to go to Washington, D.C. Back then, I was asked to do a fair amount of consulting on what to do in the former Yugoslavia, how do we end that war, and then in Somalia and Rwanda. And so I've always been a very non-academic-y academic, because I felt like I had to translate our research for a broader audience. I had to, you know, make it so that policymakers would read it and that it gave them something tangible to use. And so, you know, in 2017, I got invited to be on this task force run by the U.S. government called the Political Instability Task Force. It was around since 1994. It still exists. I served until the end of last year. And its job, you know, our job was to come up with a predictive model to help our government predict where around the world governments might become unstable and experience political violence. Now, in my field, it's so great. It's actually so great to be talking to an Americanist, because as you also know, political scientists don't talk to each other. You know, I started in international relations. I did comparative politics. We never, ever look at the United States, ever. We will talk about Syria and we'll talk about Mozambique and Cambodia. We don't talk about the United States. That's what you guys do. And so I'm on this task force on the task force, we were also not allowed to talk about the United States. And that was fine, because at the time it didn't seem like violence was a high likelihood here. And so we do this model and we sit around, we brainstorm about everything we can think of that might move a country towards civil war? Is it poverty? Is it income inequality? Is it ethnic diversity? Is it how big the country is? How many mountains there are? You know, how difficult the terrain is? And we put over 30 variables in the model, and only two came up again and again and again, highly predictive. And it was not what we expected. In fact, we were quite surprised. And the first was this variable, this weird variable we called anocracy. And that's a fancy term for partial democracy. It's a government that's neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. It's something in between. So it would, to give you an example, it would be something like Singapore, which has elections, and the citizens of Singapore love to vote. They vote in really, really high numbers. But then the outcome is essentially preordained. So there's no competition for who's going to rule Singapore. And then the second factor was this interesting thing called ethnic factionalism, which isn't polarization, because we included political polarization, how far apart ideologically, let's here in the United States, it would be the left and the right are. It was whether the citizens began to organize into political parties that were based predominantly on ethnicity, religion, or race. And the goal was to get themselves into power, not to share power, but to really try to exclude all the other competing ethnic, religious, or racial groups in society.
And so you're sitting there, I can just see the thought process working out. You're like, what are countries where you have the democracy eroding and, you know, ethnic and racial fractionalization occurring? And so I want to get more into the story of the United States. But before we do, I do want to you answered the two main sort of starting questions, which is why write a book for a general audience and why write this book right now?
Yeah.
But I thought for me, what was most revelatory was this idea that our image of civil wars is like, is really antiquated. So,
yes.
So when you're doing this research, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how scholars are thinking about civil wars today and what that means for thinking about the US.
Yeah, so there's two things that most people don't know. The first is that we are living in an age of civil wars. We are now in a world that is experiencing more civil wars than at any time in modern history. And back in the 1800s, civil wars were almost non-existent. You would have some, you know, the American Civil War, obviously, you'd have the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, but it didn't explode really until after World War II. And as you had an increasing number of independent countries around the world, and as these countries attempted to democratize, you know, along with that, you started to have more and more armed conflict. And on some level, that makes sense, because if you're opening up the political process, you're creating an opportunity for different groups to compete for power. And if they think that the window is going to close, they're gonna, you know, there's essentially a power vacuum that they're attempting to fill. So, you know, that the civil wars peaked initially in 1992 and then reversed themselves, right? You know, soon after the Soviet Union collapsed, and you know, people who studied it, we all kind of breathed a sigh of relief. Oh, thank God, you know, this, you know, the increasing number of civil wars that we're seeing is we're done with that. We're going to enter an era of peace. And that lasted until about 2002, 2003, when the trend reversed itself again, and the number of armed conflicts around the world has been increasing, and we've gone past the old 1992 peak. So that's the first thing, is that these things are happening more more frequently. And then the second thing is that they do look quite different than the old type of civil wars. They're not, they don't, it's, you don't see anything like what we saw in the 1860s, two large militaries, conventional forces, men in uniform, dragging cannons, meeting each other on a battlefield where you have the rebel army meeting the soldiers of the government. That really doesn't happen very much anymore. And the reason it doesn't happen is actually quite simple. Governments and their militaries have gotten more powerful over time. And if the government is really strong, so think about the Israeli military, think about the British military, think about the American military. Yeah. Like, would you want to take these militaries on? No, absolutely not. Who's going to have any chance against them? And so what you've seen happening is the groups that do organize for violence are using unconventional tactics. They're using domestic terror. They're using guerrilla warfare. It's almost more like what we saw during the Revolutionary War than what we saw during the American Civil War. And the reason has a lot to do with how formidable their government adversary has become. And I'll say one more thing and then I'll stop talking for a second, but it's so interesting to me. And I think it's so informative for the public. In 1860, the American military had 16,000 soldiers under arms, 16,000, that's tiny. And most of them were stationed west of the Mississippi to put down Indian uprisings. If you were the Confederate States at that time, and the Confederate States had militias that had been around for decades, well-armed, well-trained white militias that had been formed in order to prevent slave uprisings. If you're the Confederate States at that time, you know, it's not crazy for you to think, oh, we'll just meld all these militias together and we'll take on the US military. It wasn't clear that this was a losing battle. And today, of course, with the American military, it has over 2 million soldiers. You know, it's crazy to think you can take them on by directly engaging with them. And so you don't directly engage them. You target civilians. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me more about that. So, you know, to what extent? So I guess one question is a kind of technical question that you should answer very quickly, but it's basically, where do we draw the line between scattered instances of terrorism and civil war, right? Like what maybe that's a like stock and trade kind of question for you guys. But before we get to that, like what do you see then as the threat, right? I mean, let's not cut to the chase. I mean, let's not hide the, you know, bury the lead here, that the book is making a very strong case that we should be worried, you know, not freaked out, but worried about the United States and doing something to address the threat. So where does that threat come from?
Well, we know that violent extremist groups have been growing here in the United States, and they reached their previous peak in 1996 with Timothy McVeigh's attack on the federal building in Oklahoma City. Militias had been growing in the years before that. Timothy McVeigh was probably a member of one of the big Michigan militias. He had pages from the Turner Diaries, which is it's like the Bible of the far right here in the United States, that talks about, okay, if you're going to try to take on the US government, if you're going to go to war with the US government, this is how you should do it. So it reached its peak. This bombing captured the attention of everybody. The FBI was incredibly effective in infiltrating the groups and kind of dispersing them. And then we saw a surge in groups after President Obama was elected in 2008. And I've gotten a lot of hate mail from people who've been writing me and saying, you know, you talk about the far right, but you never talk about Antifa, or you don't talk about the Black Lives Matter. And the reality is that the data is very, very clear on where the growth is. In the 60s and 70s, most violent extremist groups in the United States were far left groups. They were the anarchists, the animal rights groups, the radical environmentalists. So that's where the threat in terms of domestic terror was. That's not the case today. Most of the growth has happened on the far right, and it's two types of groups. About 65% of them are between 65 and 75% are white supremacist groups. They're by far the dominant type of group. And then the remainder are mostly anti-federal government groups, and there's overlap between them. And basically, their goals are not, they're not, they haven't coordinated yet. So you do have hundreds of these small groups, and they each have their own, different goals. Some of them do want secession. Some of them want white ethno states. Some of them want to create chaos so that the federal government collapses. So, but they're the predominant type of group that we've been seeing.
And so, and on the first question, can I fairly say that for you, in this literature, that basically, you know, there can be attacks, even things as horrific as January 6th, they don't amount to civil war unless it's there's a high number of fatalities, it's an ongoing conflict, yeah. And the government is involved, right? The government kind of has to be a party in a civil war. Is that, sorry to go into the details.
The big data set that everybody uses who studies civil war is actually called the armed conflict data set. And armed conflict is this big umbrella term. And underneath that is all sorts of different types of armed conflict. You can have insurgency, you could have coups, you can have civil wars, you can have revolutions, you can have guerrilla, you know, it's a whole series of things.
It's like the Breyer's ice cream of civil conflict. Oh.
Yeah. And everybody, you know, there's a lot of quibbling about where do things stand? But mostly the conventional definition of a civil war is, and again, this is academia, so people like gradations. There's a major civil war and there's a minor civil war. And the major civil war is a conflict, a violent conflict fought by a domestic group against the government for political purposes that causes at least 1,000 deaths a year. So that's major. And of course, if you think about that in terms of a really populated country like the United States, 1,000 deaths in a year is not a lot. The attack in Oklahoma City caused almost 200. So you have five or six of those attacks and you reach that threshold. Yeah. The minor armed conflict or the minor civil war only needs to create 25 deaths a year. In my research, I don't look at the minor conflicts because I just think 25 is so small that could be one, you know, terrorist attack on a cafe. And that's quite qualitatively different from the type of, you know, conflict that I'm interested, which is bigger.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful because, I mean, to me, that was really revelatory. I was thinking about, as I said in the review, this isn't going to be North versus South like the 1860 Civil War. It's going to be more like, you know, the Northern Ireland example, right? Which is ongoing terrorist conflict. It seems a lot more realistic and frightening. And one aspect of this that I'd like you to draw out based on what you were just saying is this question of coordination. I was struck by how much social media has actually come to play a role in civil wars. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the expert on this is a woman named JJ McNabb. And I encourage your listeners and viewers to Google her. And she's been doing just fantastic work in this area. Collecting data about what exactly is happening, you know, amongst the militias. And, until recently, there was no coordination. You know, you would have a militia training in the snow in northern Michigan, you'd have a militia training in a park in Orange County, California. You know, they were maybe, you know, reading the same material online, but they were not coordinating their activities. They were not coming up with a common manifesto. So it wasn't, it seemed like it was quite dispersed. And then Charlottesville happened in 2017, which was really this rallying call of the far right, where the groups that were there were coming, you know, these were a whole mishmash of far right groups who did coordinate on that, you know, rally. And I think they were, you know, quite hopeful that this would have some effect. You know, to be honest, I don't actually know what effect they were hoping it would have. Maybe it would grow their ranks, or maybe they thought it would convince, Washington, D.C. to implement immigration reform. I don't really know, but they did come together and they were chanting similar chants. From their perspective, Charlottesville was a failure for them. And that's when you started to see them, at least the more extreme elements of those already extreme groups, begin to talk about accelerationism, accelerating the process of change through violence and civil war. And the reason it failed, in their opinion, was that there were all these videos of the people at this rally carrying torches, and their employers saw them and they got fired, and the FBI saw them and they got arrested. They got deplatformed from the social media sites where they were active. And so many of them saw that this wasn't getting them further. The second time we saw coordination, and in fact, maybe even the forming of alliances, was January 6th, where the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, the three big, big far right groups at this moment, they were in contact. They were coordinating what they were going to do prior to January 6th. And that now is actually really troublesome, because, of course, if you start to form alliances, you're a more formidable adversary, and they could, you know, do more damage as a result.
So one thing that I found really interesting in the book was this idea of Sons of the Soil movement, right? And so I'm like, what is uniting these different groups? I mean, you have white supremacists, you have anti-government people, you have people who, for whom, you know, it's sort of valorization of guns and military and sort of militias. So in this idea that there is maybe a common element in the sense of loss. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, Sons of the Soil is a concept that's been around in conflict studies for decades. So we actually know who tends to start ethnic wars. There's been over, 200 civil wars since 1946, major armed conflicts. The almost 60% of them have been, ethnic wars. And we know who tends to start them. And again, it's a surprise for most people. It's not the most downtrodden groups in a country. It's not the poorest groups. It's not the groups that are most discriminated against. It's certainly not the immigrants who organize and try to fight the government. These are weak, disempowered groups, and they often have absolutely no capacity to mobilize resistance to a government. The groups that tend to start civil wars are these Sons of the Soil groups. These are groups that had been politically dominant in a country, and they either had recently lost power or they were in the process of losing power. So it's the groups that who see a region or a country as fundamentally theirs. They were the first people there, or they are the majority of the population there. They're the ones whose language is spoken, it's their culture that's practiced, their religion that's practiced. And what happens, and it happened to the Muslims in Southern Philippines, it happened to the Assamese in India, it happened to the you know Abkhaz people in Georgia. You know, they go from inhabiting a piece of land that is that they truly believe is theirs, and then there's in-migration. There's in-migration, like in Assam, in India, it's right next door to Bangladesh. Bangladesh is overflowing with people. And when the British were in India, they needed, you know, they needed farmers to farm the land. And Assam, you know, had a lot of land. It needed civil servants who could help the British government rule. And they brought in lots of migrants. You know, in the Philippines, it's the same thing. So you see in migration that sometimes slowly, but sometimes actually quite rapidly changes the demographics. And in a way that the sons of the soil cannot stop. And they start to feel incredibly threatened, or oftentimes, you know, ambitious members of their group who don't want to give up power. Who have power in the current system but don't want to lose it, they will begin to organize to try to fight off this demographic change. And so and they tend to be relatively powerful because they had controlled the instruments of state. They generally, you know, have the resources and the know-how. And they tend to also be protected in some cases because they either still are in power or they recently had been in power, and they're the ones who tend to fight.
Well, I mean, and just everyone, I'm loving these questions you're putting in the Q&A, and I want to get to them very, very shortly, but I hope you will forgive me for asking just one or two more quick questions before we go to them, because after all, I read this book, I wrote the review, and now I've got this chance to talk with the author one-on-one. So they are protected right now by key features of our political system. And so it's sort of irony is that you're writing about this group that's feeling deeply dispossessed, yes. And members of which, small numbers of which, numbers of which, but not enough of a large enough share with given the amount of weaponry in our society and the sophistication of this coordination that you're talking about could do real damage. But at the same time, we have a Senate that's tilted towards less populous, yep. White, more likely to be, white majority states. We have gerrymandering that's been done by Republicans that has tended to accentuate, you know, the biases toward the Republican Party at the state level. So, you know, and we had a president elected in 2016 without winning a majority of the popular vote. Yep. And so, you know, I'm trying to think about like what the relationship is between these two realities. One is that we have a system that still gives a disproportionate amount of power to sons of the soil. And yet at the same time, a sense of threat and backlash that it's palpable and as you say, potentially quite dangerous. So how do you think about the relationship?
Part of it is people do see changes happening in their town or in the national level or culturally, right? I mean, think about the musical Hamilton, right? This was about our founding story, and all of the main characters were non-white. If that could be quite shocking to people who have a very strong sense of what the identity of this country should be, and especially what they're seeing is different from them. But part of it also has to be crafted. And I think the Republican Party, as you well know, has been crafting an identity for itself to attract first, you know, Southern whites and then evangelicals. And they're now in a situation where, they've built a party that is not inclusive and is shrinking relative to other groups in society. And so they're in this bind where, democracy, if our democracy is really one person, one vote, they can't win in that democracy. And so they have to somehow convince their supporters many of whom I have no doubt are patriotic Americans who you know, if you told them that we're going to get rid of democracy, would be angry. And so the leadership that's put themselves in this bind has to somehow convince these people that the system we have is illegitimate, that the system is stealing their votes. And I think that's how they're getting there. But I think also I'll wait.
Okay. Well, no, but that actually gets to a question from, and you guys are all going to have to forgive me if I mess up your names, but, and there's two Michaels, so I definitely can't just use first names here. Michael Monroney. I already mixed up the Michaels. I'm going to get you Michael Monroney, but this is Michael Green's question, which is really about how important Trump is in this story. Yeah. Both, and he says, did and does. So, does, you know, what role did and does Trump play in inspiring the far right to violence and civil unrest? And I guess that can lead into, into this question of like, how much is this a threat that you think will outlast Trump's presence on the political stage, however long that is?
You know, I think Trump is just a symptom of a larger set of phenomenon that have been happening for decades here in the United States. And I think you could tell this story entirely without even talking about Trump. If Trump hadn't emerged, somebody else like Trump would have emerged. And if Trump isn't the Republican candidate in 2024, there will be somebody who uses his same playbook. It might be Josh Hawley, it might be Tom Cotton, but they're just symptoms of this, of what's this, okay. America is going through this enormous demographic transformation. The US is going to be the first white majority country in the world to go through it. But Canada is going to be next. New Zealand's going to come after them, then Australia. And it's expected that by 2100, the countries of Europe, the white majority countries of Europe, will also probably transition to being less than a majority of whites. And this creates an absolute sons of the soil situation where whites are starting to see that they are losing out in this new system, that you have immigrants from India and China who are getting great tech jobs in the Bay Area, and they're living the American dream, that they and their children who are living, you know, in a rural state are not getting. They see that their quality of life has not improved. That white marriage rates have declined, divorce rates have increased, suicides have increased at levels above non-whites in this country. And so I do, you know, they're deeply resentful. They feel this loss of status. They believe that it's their, you know, that it's their right to have a better life, to set the tone in the United States. And I think that's what's sort of moving at least some of them to the radical right. Talking about Trump, or, you know, this transition happened really starting in 2008, long before anybody thought Trump, you know, people laughed back then if you had told them that Trump was going to be president. And I do think that the election of an African-American president really shocked many white Americans. And then Obama's first cabinet was majority non-white. And I think that it did create this sons of the soil dynamic where they're just like, what is happening to our country? This is not our country. It's being taken over and taken away from us, and we have to do something about it.
So, sorry, I was just getting a note about our plan for the evening, and we still got a lot of time. So I was just gonna, and that leads in actually really naturally to a question that comes up with a lot of folks here, because you've talked about social media and those who could be mobile, those who are mobilizing or could be mobilized to participate in violence. But I wonder a lot of people are just interested in the more general media landscape, which kind of fits in too with thinking about how Trump was able to gain power and attract, you know, substantial support within the electorate. I'm wondering how you think about the broader media landscape, maybe Fox News in this. And one question, I guess it has to do with the relationship between those who actually carry out violence and those who sort of either sanction it or look the other way, if there's, you know, right way to think about that relationship, right? Because, and to what extent you're seeing the, there a kind of shift in attitudes within the United States, a broader shift in attitudes within the United States, at least among, you know, Republican allied voters.
You know, we tend to think about it, people who look at conflict and how it starts is, you know, the average person doesn't want war. They don't want to fight. You know, they mostly just want to be left alone to live a good life if they can live a good life. And they don't want war because, you know, these poor schmucks are the ones who are going to probably pay the costs of the war. But, you know, you have these politicians or media elites, you have these individuals who want power, and they're willing, you know, some of them are willing to go to really extreme measures to get power. And we actually call them ethnic entrepreneurs. Slobodan Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia was an ethnic entrepreneur. He was a communist during the Soviet era in Yugoslavia, and he held power then. And then the Soviet Union collapsed, and Yugoslavs could pick whatever government they wanted. And they decided they wanted a democracy. And Milosevic is in this bind. He wants to keep power, but he knows that, that average Yugoslavs hate communists, and they know that he's a communist. So he's also quite smart and savvy. And he realizes that the biggest ethnic group in Yugoslavia are the Serbs, and he's Serb. So he starts, he grabs control of the airwaves, the state-controlled radio, state-controlled television, and he just starts just pushing out this narrative of fear and threat and change. And it's over months and months and months. And he manages to convince average Serbs that if they don't form into a Serb party, regardless of what the ideology of that is, and if they don't back a Serb like Milosevic, then the Croats are going to do the same thing. And the Croats are going to come to power. And once the Croats are in power, they're going to throw all the Serbs out of their government jobs and out of the military. And then they might actually even start killing them the way some of them did in World War II. And it was really, really effective. And so what you see is these ethnic entrepreneurs, whether it's a Donald Trump or it's a Rupert Murdoch or it's a Joe Rogan, you know, they have figured out that if they could tap into people's sense of threat and fear, that they will follow, that they will have a loyal following who won't leave them. Because if your loyalty is based on your identity, there's nowhere else for you to go. If you're a Serb, you can't join a Croat party. And it gives these individuals a lot of leeway to do what they want and to gain, you know, a lot of power as a result. And so propaganda is a really important tool for bringing your average citizen behind you in your quest for power.
Well, first I want to say I'm taking all my music off of Spotify after hearing about Joe Rogan. There are so many great questions here, and I'm going to try to draw them together into a few broad themes. And I think there's one that, you know, I think let's take this one right now, which is, you know, pushback from those who feel like, you know, that this is impugning an entire political party and that, you know, Republicans are very well very likely to capture, you know, both the House and the Senate in 2022. What does this tell us? And I'm not asking you to, you know, I'll just say for the record, like I actually find your identification, this is primarily a problem that's emerging on the far right, very convincing, and the evidence supports it. But I do think it kind of gets to just what you were talking about, which is to think about, here's one way to put it, which is, to what extent does it take, is this conflict going to be suppressed to the extent that Republicans are able to do well in American politics? Are we waiting for another Barack Obama? Or do you believe that that now that sort of the genie's out of the bottle, it's not really dependent upon the reality of power relations and much more about these perceptions, which, you know, in the case of the 2020 election, right, the perception, the false belief that Donald Trump won is widely held, right, despite the fact that there's literally no evidence to support that. So how do you feel, like, how much does the real world matter in this story you're telling going forward? And you know, how do you feel about the I'm sure you get this pushback. So how do you feel about this sort of point about what's the place of the Republican Party as a whole in this story?
Oh, wow. That is, you know, there's one party. Well, it's so party. I don't like to treat it as monolithic. Like, when I think about parties or when I think about voters, I like to think of a spectrum. Like Republicans, there's reasonable, moderate Republicans, and it goes all the way to the most extreme. They're violent extremists in the Republican parties, and it's the same on the left. You have reasonable, you know, Democrats, and then it goes all the way to the extreme where you have, you know, violent extremists on the far left. The difference is in the numbers. Like, it's all, you know, the growth is really, you know, almost all of it is on the far right. And it fits with what we know historically about who would mobilize during these times of transition. It's, you know, it's not gonna be the mishmash of different groups on the left who actually, when you think about what they're in a strategically good position. All they have to do is wait. You know, time is on their side. Every year there's fewer and fewer whites as a portion of the population and more non-whites. And the opposite is true for whites. So we know that the growth in militias is on the far right. We know that the hate crimes are on the far right. We know that the incidences of domestic terror are predominantly on the far right. And then a separate issue from that is what the non-violent extremists what the more moderate Republicans are doing. And I mean, I think this is it, to most people's surprise, they're doing a whole series of really undemocratic things. And so they're working within the system, which is different from the accelerationist groups. It's quite, you know, it's not the same as what the Proud Boys are doing. They're working within the system, but what they're really trying to do is they're trying to cement in minority rule, or at least they want to create a system that will allow them to continue to win elections, even if they don't have a majority of Americans supporting them. And that's unraveling our democracy. And again, if I go back to the task force, you know, every year the United States remains, it dipped into the inocracy zone by the end of the Trump era. It's now out of it, but it could, you know, it could dip back in pretty easily. Every year the US is an inocracy and has one of its two main parties essentially acting like an ethnic faction. The risk of political violence is almost 4%. That doesn't seem like a lot, but it is. That means if those two features continue for 30 years, the risk is over 100%. So it's like smoking. If I started smoking today, my risk of dying is low. But in 30, 40, 50 years, it would be quite high.
Yeah, so that's a sobering thought. And it makes me think that it's pretty important to address this challenge. And you have some ideas for how to do that in the book. And And I just want to say, like, so I really, these are great questions, and I wish I could get to more of them. I mean, there are now 27 in the queue. But I do think for all of us, probably the number one question is how should we understand the challenge we face, right? So what do you think are both the most effective and perhaps sort of tempering that with some sense of what is the most realistic things we could do? You know, if you had this is a question I hate because people always ask me that when I talk about my work. It's like, well, if you had, you know, if you could do one thing, what would it be? But maybe at least, you know, think about what are the few things that would be most effective and then maybe we can talk a little bit about how likely they would be to occur.
I mean, in an ideal world, it would be strengthen our democracy, but we're not going to be able to do that because the Republicans have no incentive to do that. They're going to be hurt by reform. And the Democrats, we now know, don't have the votes. So the ideal solution is off the table. You know, I think there's three things. One, you know, simply knowing what these two warning signs are is really important.
By the way, I know what the two warnings are saying. We've talked about it, but there is a question in the chat which would like us to define more precisely what anocracy is. So,
okay. Yeah. So Anna, if you think about, you can have all sorts of different governments from negative 10, which is the most autocratic government. This is North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, to the most democratic, which is plus 10. This is Denmark and Iceland and Canada. Anocracy are those that go from negative 5 to plus 5. They're in that middle zone. They have some features of democracy, but, you know, for example, they might have a president who has very few checks and balances on his or her power.
Right. Okay. So, and then the other is this growing, not just polarization, but this like factionalization that is occurring where there's like all the alignments are getting subsumed within this kind of ethno-religious slash racial conflict. Okay. So where do you see the two warning signs? What should we do?
You know, simply having Americans aware of it and talking about it. Like I've been writing this book for the last few years and nobody was talking about it. Nobody wanted to hear it. And people just dismissed it. It's not possible. So even the fact that we're having this conversation is huge because people I think are less likely to be complacent, to think, oh, well, you know, our democracy has weakened a bit, but boy, we're a long way from Iran, so we don't have to worry about it. And one of it is, no, actually this middle zone is really dangerous. And, you know, the second thing, regulate social media. That's probably the single easiest thing we can do. The five biggest tech companies in the world are all US companies. And I'm not talking about, you know, control information, like let people put whatever they want online, but don't create recommendation engines. Don't create algorithms that take the most incendiary, the most hate-filled, the most fear-mongering type of information and disseminate it wider than information that's calming and positive and more likely to bring a society together. That would be a really pretty easy fix. And there's a lot of smart people who used to work for places like, you know, Google and Facebook who've been giving very specific recommendations on how you do that. And then, you know, the third is I'm a huge advocate of peaceful protest. There's a woman at the Kennedy School at Harvard, Erica Chenoweth, who's done, you know, who spent her life studying peaceful protests. And what she finds is it's incredibly effective in getting the attention of governments, both democratic and undemocratic, and getting them to institute reforms. You know, politicians would prefer to have people stay in their houses and just kind of blindly follow along. And if you have mass protests day after day after day, and whether you're protesting against, you know, voter suppression, or you're protesting against, you know, attempts to concentrate power in the executive branch, or you're protesting the fact that, you know, we had an insurrection in the Capitol and you know, the reaction by at least one party is really shocking. It's hard for politicians to ignore that. If you think about Tunisia and Egypt, these were deeply authoritarian governments. Their leaders had been in power for decades, and it took just a few weeks of massive protests, and both Ben Ali and Mubarak, they left. And so you could just imagine how effective this could be in a democracy where our politicians really, really do have to take into account what the American people want.
Well, that's actually a pretty optimistic note. And I definitely don't want to leave people feeling as if this is a hopeless situation. One of the things I really appreciated about the book is that you spend a long time talking about things we could do. Let me ask you this sort of closing question, which is related to that, which is, you know, do you feel as if, and maybe this is a little bit too self-referential, but do you feel as if the book might be making a difference? Do you see for the book and other people who are making this argument, you know, do you see that changing how policy is being done, or more awareness of the problem, and sort of what do you recommend besides peaceful protest to citizens in terms of encouraging their public officials to pay more attention?
Yeah, I mean, Jacob, I really don't know if this is going to have an effect, or if it's just going to be, you know, the conversation du jour for a month or two, and then it will go away. I do think, though, that some of these important concepts, like the danger of anocracy, like the danger of ethnic factions, like this larger phenomenon that we know about, Sons of the Soil, will stick with people, and at least they'll have, you know, some framework to understand what is oftentimes a really complex problem. So it gives them entree to understand it. But, you know, one other thing that people could do, you know, of course, is vote. The 2020 elections, as you know, had really, really high turnout. You know, the Republicans did an amazing job on the ground, and they brought out, you know, millions of voters, and they still lost. And even with this historically high turnout, almost 80 million eligible voters didn't vote. You know, that could be a game changer. You know, if those people did vote, even if one party does try to suppress the vote and make it more difficult and do, you know, all sorts of things, you know, people, you know, they can still go out and vote. They'll have to persevere. They'll have to, you know, stand in line. But you know, if 80 million people, you know, vote, that's going to change the composition of the House and the Senate, and maybe we will get reforms.
Well, so, you know, I hope that that's the case. I really would love to see people reading this book, and I'm glad to see so many on this webinar. I'm really grateful to the Free Library of Philadelphia for making it possible. I'm really grateful to you, Barbara, for writing this book, and grateful to all of you for these many questions. Though I must say, if my students asked as many questions as this, my lectures would never end. And so thank you all. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all, but please do read the book, and, you know, please do do what Barbara said, get out there and vote and make your voice heard. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jacob. I really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Happy teaching.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.